KUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Just talking to a single person that still lives in Gaza or reading their testimony or seeing a video, and this is the day-to-day reality for everyone. For children, for elderly, for the people who had been classified as rich, for the people who had been classified as poor, for the people in the north, for the people in the south. Gaza is the only territory where everyone is starving. And what does that look like for these people? I mean, I can't imagine looking at my child and telling them, I have no food for you. Not just today, but for the foreseeable future. And that child, you know, people have described their child's screams for food as among the most torturous sounds you can possibly hear. And there's a million of these stories.
Since October 2023, Israel's siege on Gaza has turned food, the most basic human need, into a weapon of war. The UN has called Gaza the most hungriest place on earth. Today, the entire population is on the brink of famine. Babies are dying, mothers can't produce milk, and even if food is allowed in, for many, it may already be too late, because refeeding after starvation can be just as deadly. Nearly 800 Palestinians have been killed just trying to access food at the U.S. and Israel-backed aid network called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, run by private American military contractors and coordinated with the Israeli army. Instead of relief, these sites have become militarized death traps where hungry Palestinians are met with gunfire and violence. Our guest today is Dr. Yara Ossi, a Palestinian public health expert who's been sounding the alarm since the start of this genocide. We talk about the science of famine, the deadly effects of starvation and refeeding on the human body, and how Gaza's food system and its people are being systematically dismantled. Thanks for listening. This is the MondoWise Podcast. Welcome, Dr. Ossi, to the MondoWise Podcast. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about famine in Gaza, how close are we to that technical declaration? And what does that framing miss about what people are already experiencing?
This is a really important question, because I think we have been talking about hunger in Gaza for almost the full 2 years at this point. And there have been famine warnings as early as the spring of 2024. That's when you saw the kind of ill-advised peer idea. That's when you started seeing those aid drops that killed many Palestinians. But we're now entering a new phase after the siege imposed by Israel in early March, basically a complete siege, even more restrictive than the siege they imposed after October 7th. So now we're in a situation where almost no aid or even commercial goods are entering Gaza. And there has been this, I don't even know what to call it, this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that is an Israeli and U.S. backed organization, agency. We don't even know what to call it because it's so opaque. That is the only entity available to distribute aid in Gaza right now because of Israeli permissions. And I'm sure anyone who's listening or watching this has heard basically every day Palestinians are being massacred at these aid sites. So there's a lot of issues with that. But going back to your question about famine, in May 2025, the Integrated Food Security Phase classification, known as the IPC, it's kind of the global famine watchdog organization. It was set up to warn exactly of situations like this, released their most recent report about Gaza. And they warned that Gaza is confronted with what they're still calling a critical risk of famine. Now, the entire population of Gaza is facing high levels of acute food insecurity, and 500,000 people, so this is about 1 in 5, are facing starvation. Unlike many other settings of mass starvation or even famine that have existed in the past decade or more, Gaza is the only territory on the planet where it's the entire population that is facing prolonged food shortages. The World Health Organization has called it one of the world's worst hunger crises unfolding in real time. And this is not because of drought. This is not because of pests that have destroyed crops. This is entirely due to Israel's control of the border and their unwillingness to allow the humanitarian agencies who have been tasked previously, like the World Food Program and UNRWA, with distributing aid in Gaza to function. But while these statistics themselves are frightening, this prospect that 500,000 people potentially are facing days, if not weeks, without food, it misses really what the lived experience of starving and watching your family starve really feels like. There has been some incredibly touching and harrowing writing coming out of Gaza from those who are experiencing this. And I really recommend people to check out those firsthand accounts. But just from hearing these stories and talking to friends and colleagues that are still there, we know that people are rationing the small bits of food that they can get. Often it's flour, so they're just baking bread, perhaps having that with olive oil if they have that. They're often prioritizing feeding their children or elderly relatives over themselves. They're living off, as I said, bread and whatever canned food they can find. They may have some left over from previous aid distribution. They may be getting it from these new sites. But they're reporting, you know, being really terrified now of even leaving their house to try to get food at one of these four distribution sites. Mm-hmm. So prior to the March siege, there was more than 400 food distribution sites around Gaza in the UN system. With this new GHF, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, there are four sites in all of Gaza. So this means people who are starving, sick, ill, homeless, you know, any other number of conditions are often having to travel many miles to go to one of these sites where food is not guaranteed. Many people report getting to the site safely and not leaving with food because there wasn't enough. Or more frighteningly, as we've heard, they're terrified of getting killed, getting massacred at one of these sites. There was an interview in the BBC mm-hmm. with a father who explicitly said, you know, we thought this was a place where we could go get food for our children. It's a death trap. It's a killing. Don't go there. So now we're seeing people mm-hmm. faced with this prospect of displacement, starvation, or potentially getting killed by Israeli tanks or snipers trying to get food. And this is every day for months and weeks. And I don't know if we can even begin to appreciate how traumatic physically and mentally living in these conditions is, and knowing that the food that you desperately need is just across the border, sitting in trucks, and no one is really agitating to get you that food. I can't imagine the mental and physical toll. It's beyond horrific to witness, and I can't imagine what it's like to live in those conditions.
Yeah, I mean, horrific conditions. And as you said, with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, we're seeing daily massacres, daily shootings. And I believe you said it was before the genocide, there was 400 UN-run aid delivery organizations there. And now there's four. I think it's important to highlight that this is a population of you know, 2 million plus people. And now the aid they're getting is essentially being ran by private military contractors. And as you said, daily massacres there. And I think it's important to talk about before October 7th, before this genocide started. You've written a lot about how Israel used food as a weapon. Mm-hmm. And that didn't start just now. It's been a longstanding policy. Right. Can you walk us through how food has been weaponized over the years, even before, you know, this current genocide?
Absolutely. And, you know, just to clarify, those 400 distribution sites, those were just a few months ago, not even prior to October 7th. So mm-hmm. even in a situation of acute food insecurity and potential famine, there was at least sites that were administered mm-hmm. by the UN and its humanitarian agencies like UN OCHA and UNRWA, supported by the World Food Program. That entire infrastructure, which is literally built to prevent hunger and famine, mm-hmm. has been displaced by, as you say, essentially private military contractors that coordinate with the Israelis, with the support of the Americans, with at these four sites. And last I've checked, not even all four of the sites are open. It's only three of the sites. So yes, it's been a significant shrinkage in just a very short period of time for these people. So unfortunately, the only reason that Israel is able to be so successful in these efforts and in weaponizing food and aid is because of the existing infrastructure that existed before early March, before October 7th, really for decades, even before the blockade of 2007. But I think that's really where we start to see this shift in this weaponization of food. For decades, Palestinians and their allies have warned about the potential consequences of Israel's near complete control of the movement of goods and people in and out of the occupied territory. So we're talking about both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip here. But since the blockade started in Gaza in the early 2000s, it has escalated significantly. A UN report from 2022, so more than a year before October 7th, found that 65% of people in Gaza were already food insecure due to Israel's policies. And these policies are really diverse. This includes restrictions on specific foods. And you can read many articles that have been written that talk about the arbitrary nature of this. And sometimes it was strawberries were banned, Coca-Cola was banned, potato chips was banned, certain types of baby food were banned. Obviously, this is all under Israel's security pretext, but no one can reasonably argue that there was any security pretext here. And Israel didn't even attempt to. Because in the words of an Israeli government advisor in 2006, when they were kind of developing what the blockade would look like, he said, quote, "The idea is to put the Palestinians on a diet, but not to make them die of hunger," unquote. And to enable this, in 2008, the Israeli government commissioned a study to work out exactly how many calories Palestinians would need to avoid malnutrition and only allow just that amount of calories worth of truckloads to enter Gaza. So we've heard a lot about the trucks that need to enter Gaza, how they need 300, 400, 500 a day. Even before October 7th, there was not sufficient entry of trucks because of this kind of minimum restriction that Israel was imposing. The report, this 2008 study, was only released to the public following a 2012 legal battle with Israeli human rights organizations. And so Israel has utilized its control of what enters Gaza, you know, for a really long time. They control all the land crossings. They control even the distance that Gaza's fishermen are allowed to go into the sea to get fish. You know, Gaza is a coastal community. It should be very seafood dependent, as we see with any right. other nation or territory on that coast. And Gaza has been artificially, kind of restricted in its ability to produce its own food. And in not just this most recent military campaign, but all the previous ones prior to 2023, they would bomb food factories, food distribution facilities where food was stored. They would bomb the refrigerated trucks that food was in. They would bomb agricultural lands. They would kill livestock, you know, cows, sheep, chickens. There has been some harrowing pictures of chicken farms, just absolutely everything is black because it's, you know, it's been destroyed. It's so not just the ability to import food, but the ability to produce food in Gaza has been, completely interrupted by the Israeli regime. And another way that food insecurity was increased by the blockade is that it really limited, it strangled economic development. So for many families, they were unable to afford even the food that was available in markets simply because there's no jobs. Unemployment in Gaza was extremely high, especially for young folks just graduating college. These are the folks that are just, you know, starting their lives, having children. They could not afford to support those families. And so by restricting aid, by restricting the ability of people in Gaza to grow and produce their own food, and by creating an economic crisis such that people can't afford food that's available, through all of those mechanisms, Israel has controlled Palestinians' supply and availability of food in Gaza.
Yeah, those are all really great points and really important for people to know. And, you know, when people hear these words like famine, starvation, I don't think people really understand like what is actually happening to the human body. We see, you know, just like apocalyptic images coming out of Gaza of children, you know, very malnourished, of parents, of everyone there. Can you explain what happens to the human body under, you know, these famine-like conditions or these, you know, very close to famine-like conditions, especially to children? During this prolonged starvation, what kind of conditions or diseases do we start seeing as, you know, malnutrition starts to set in?
Right. So famine is really just a severe, long-term, population-wide, widespread shortage of food. And it leads to malnutrition, to starvation, and in many cases, ultimately to death. It's the most extreme form of hunger crisis. So it affects every bodily function, whether you're at the malnutrition stage where you are able to get, you know, some calories, but you're not eating fresh fruits and vegetables. You're not getting your full vitamins and minerals, fiber, protein, you know, all those micro and macronutrients that make a, you know, healthy diet. And then there's starvation, right? Which is where you're just not getting food, or maybe you're getting intermittent amounts of food and the food that you are getting is not balanced. You know, you can't live healthily off bread or rice every day, but if you're starving, you will eat that. So the effect on the body is really significant, and especially with children, because children are growing, their bodies are growing, and they're utilizing those nutrients to grow their body, to get bigger, for their brain to continue to develop, for their muscles to grow. So it's particularly we see the effects of malnutrition and starvation on children and pregnant mothers. So for children, we see impaired growth. So this can be stunted growth, which is where the child is too short for their age. And this impacts their entire body over the lifespan. So even if some of these children are able to, you know, have a healthy diet at some point moving forward, the effects of stunting are often not reversible. And then there's wasting, which, you know, many of us, I think many of those listening or watching have seen photos or videos of, basically skeletal starving children in Gaza. And this is where a child is too thin for their height. This is life-threatening, and this increases the risk of death from malnutrition and starvation. We also know that malnutrition can negatively impact the development of the brain, as I said. And this can lead to long-term and potentially lifelong issues with learning, with memory, with critical thinking and problem solving skills. We actually, you know, as you can imagine, there's not a lot of research on the health effects of famine and starvation, because you kind of have to study one that's happened. You cannot, obviously, for ethical reasons, manufacture or produce one. So what we have is evidence from previous periods of famine and starvation. This has been almost 2 years with no end in sight. So we don't know, you know, the full depth of how these problems may be. Another real issue that I know we're going to talk about briefly is increased susceptibility to illness. So when your body is not nourished, when you don't have all the vitamins, minerals, fats, carbohydrates that you need, your immune system becomes much weakened. So ailments that originally, you know, might not be a big deal for a healthy child. You know, if a healthy child gets the flu, it's disruptive, but with rest, with medication, with water, they will be fine. You know, for most of us, the flu is not a big issue. When you enter a malnourished child, you know, state, and you have children that are getting even just common colds, or even, you know, potential injuries, breaking a bone, their body is just too weak to fight, too weak to rebuild. And this can make regular ailments or small infections or, you know, issues like that can become life-threatening that ordinarily would not be. And, you know, then there's the question of how does this affect you mentally over the lifespan? So we know from looking at survivors of famine from labor and concentration camps in the past that even if the body, recovers mentally, the toll of starving, of not knowing where your next food is going to come from, what will that food be? You know, none of us really, in most of the developed world, understand what hunger really feels like. It is not just a feeling in the stomach, as many of the writers from Gaza have illustrated. It is a full body disconnection. You feel as though you can't speak, you can't think. And so how do you recover from basically this long trauma over the lifespan? So increased stress, increased lifelong anxiety, potentially depression, potentially if with children, behavioral problems. And then the nutritional deficiencies of long-term malnutrition can lead to all sorts of health issues as people age. This includes anemia, potentially diabetes, and cardiovascular diseases like heart disease and hypertension. So how each individual case will progress over the lifespan, it's impossible to predict, but we know on the population scale, we will see some mix of death, long-term deficiencies, mental health problems, and children or people dying from ailments that they otherwise would easily be able to recover from.
And, you know, the obviously the solution to all of this is to end the genocide and, you know, start bringing in large scale amount of aid. But there are dangers to, you know, quickly refeeding a population that's been put through these conditions. Right. Can you explain why reintroducing food too quickly can be dangerous for people who've been starving?
Yeah. So this feels and sounds a bit counterintuitive, right? That you would think that if people are starving, the best thing you can do for them is give them large quantities of food and essentially allow them to eat as much as possible. Now, not only is this outcome not realistic for people in Gaza at the moment, but as you noted, it is potentially dangerous and potentially even lethal. When you're starving, you know, your body will do anything it can to keep you alive in any conditions. That's what it's adapted to do. And when you're starving, your body adapts to keep you alive despite the lack of nutrients and calories. And this includes shifts in how your body processes energy, and your metabolism shifts accordingly to, you know, different percentages of fats versus carbohydrates versus proteins. Mm-hmm. It changes how your body produces insulin, which causes complications in absorbing electrolytes, which we need to be healthy. Your sodium and water mm-hmm. balance can become disrupted if you refeed too quickly. This can lead to edema, which is swelling of the limbs, and can even lead to heart failure in some cases. What essentially happens is that your body that has been starving becomes overwhelmed by having to kind of restart or readapt these metabolic processes that it had created to keep you alive. And it, you know, or really started to shut down because they were not being used. And so if you trigger everything too quickly, and this is really a clinical process that needs to happen, it can lead to even death, which is, I mean, you know, of all the things to imagine, the idea that refeeding a starving population too quickly can also lead to death, it just shows you how complex managing famine and starvation is. And that is why we should never allow it to exist in the first place. It is completely avoidable in this day and age. There's no reason any population should be hungry.
Yeah. And as like, you know, as we know, the Gaza healthcare system is completely dismantled. There's essentially no healthcare system. The conditions keep, you know, getting worse and worse and worse. And as you point out earlier with the aid that is allowed in, it's not sufficient, and it's really very dangerous to get the aid. So if there was a hopeful scenario where large amount of aid is getting through, there would need to be some kind of, you know, education to teach people how to, you know, to eat their food that they, you know, have been deprived of for so long. But with the healthcare system being gone and the desperation that people have right now, it seems like it would just be a scenario where you might see some of those complications large scale happen, because there wouldn't be an education campaign of how people should reintroduce the food that they need.
Yeah, I mean, in the best cases, you know, humanitarianism, especially as it relates to Palestinians, is incredibly problematic. And that's a conversation for a different episode. But what they do have that private military contractors don't is expertise. Mm. And so ideally, if there was some sort of effort to greatly increase aid into Gaza, it would be managed by skilled professionals, medical professionals, distribution professionals. It would not just be, well, let's suddenly make a bunch of food available and let the population have at it. You know, that's when we start seeing chaos. That's when we start seeing these, you know, refeeding issues. It doesn't need to be that way. There is, as there was a consortium of humanitarian agencies shortly after the GHF was announced, who said, you know, these aren't humanitarian people. We have the expertise. We have the local knowledge. We have, you know, for the trust of the population. Let us do our jobs instead of trying to treat this as a distribution or logistic issue, because it's not.
Dr. Asi, can you speak a little bit about for how this experience is for pregnant women, breastfeeding mothers? What are the specific risks for both for the mothers and the babies?
Yes. So we know from previous settings of war, armed conflict, genocide, that most deaths will not be battle related. So they will not be due to bombs, due to snipers, due to raids, as horrific as those incidences are. We know that an estimated 3 to 5 times more people will die from indirect causes. And while infectious disease and starvation are two pillars of those indirect causes, the third is increased maternal and infant mortality. So the death, the premature death of pregnant or new mothers and their babies. So what does this mean? There's an increased risk of complications during the pregnancy due to malnutrition. This can mean anemia, preeclampsia, and even hemorrhage during the birth, all of which can be severely harmful to the mother, including life-threatening. Malnutrition in mothers can lead to maternal death and obviously the death of the fetus, the baby. Malnutrition also, and we've heard a lot of firsthand accounts of these that are just so tragic. Malnutrition makes it difficult for a new mother to breastfeed because she doesn't have the nutrients to produce milk. We've heard that formula for babies is one of the things that is being heavily restricted and that people are having a really hard time getting. We've even heard anecdotes of mothers just giving their baby sugar water or milk diluted mostly with water just so they have something to give the baby. This is obviously for a growing infant, a newborn, can be extremely dangerous, potentially lethal. Risks for the baby include being born at a low birth weight. We've heard a lot of stories about these or that are otherwise just too small for their gestational age. This can lead to significant developmental delays in a baby, both as a fetal development and also development up during the first few months and first year. Especially, this can mean developmental and cognitive delays and deficits. Same as we talked about earlier, this goes tenfold for new mothers and new babies, this increased risk of infection. So babies have, you know, very little ability on their own to fight infection. They receive antibodies from vaccines, which the vaccinations all across Gaza have, you know, basically gone offline for the time being, at least, or through their breast milk of their mother. So they have neither of those opportunities and they're malnourished. So any common cold, COVID, any respiratory infection, skin rash, even diaper rash, you know, something relatively anodyne for most of us can be incredibly painful and dangerous for a baby that is malnourished. And from, like I said, this just increases mortality from common childhood illnesses in general. So if a child gets chickenpox or gets any of these other ailments, their body's ability to fight it is almost zero. And so we are going to, we know anecdotally this is happening, but as in the coming months and years, as we're able to look back at all the dead and how they died, I fear that this will be a significant cause of death for many children and babies. And again, talking about the lifespan, we will see impaired brain development for babies that do survive, right? So when we talk about survivors, we're often talking about, you know, these are the people lucky enough to survive. But many of those who survive, especially infants, babies, toddlers, will have cognitive and developmental deficits and delays because of the malnutrition and starvation they experience as children. And their mothers, you know, have very limited ability to help them. You know, these mothers, many of them who won't, you know, who will survive childbirth, won't be able to nurse, won't be able to give their baby medication. It's just a very fragile time, even in the best health system. This is a very fragile time. You know, mothers can die in a hospital with skilled medical professionals. Babies can die in a NICU with access to an incubator and every other possible medication or treatment they would need. Take all of that away. and you create an extremely fragile and vulnerable situation for infants and mothers.
Yeah. Are there any specific diseases or outbreaks you're most concerned about right now, given the combination of malnutrition, poor sanitation, is, you know, destroyed healthcare infrastructure?
Yeah. So what makes this difficult is that we have very little primary data to work with, because obviously Israel is not letting outside health officials or advisors really work in Gaza. The health officials on the ground, those that have survived, because we know at least 1,400 have been killed, are busy offering trauma care, trying to take care of their own families, trying to secure their own food. So we're not really able to get great primary data. From what we do know, and from what data has been released by heroic epidemiological and public health officials that are still in Gaza, this is how the polio outbreak in the summer was caught. There seems to be a real significant increase in hepatitis A. There's been over 40,000 cases since October 7th, compared to just a few dozen cases in the year before that. This is due to unclean water and just living in unhygienic conditions. We're really concerned about diarrheal diseases. This includes cholera. There's been a significant increase in diarrhea cases, especially in children. And, you know, waterborne illnesses was a leading cause of death in children in Gaza before October 7th, because, and I know Mondo Weiss has done a lot of reporting on the poor water infrastructure in Gaza and how, you know, what, like 95 some percent of the water was not potable. So there was already a water crisis. Obviously, that has been significantly exacerbated. There has been more than 150,000 cases of diarrheal diseases, and these can kill children and vulnerable people like the elderly or people with chronic illnesses, because they become dehydrated very quickly and they're unable to refeed or rehydrate because there's nothing available. Skin diseases, we've seen some really harrowing images of especially children and babies that have unidentified skin rashes, sometimes across their whole back, their whole chest, their whole body, because they're living in very overcrowded and unclean conditions. They're unable to shower. Many of them don't have access to soap even. We've heard doctors reporting that they were unable to wash their hands between procedures because of lack of soap, lack of water. And so these skin diseases, while on the less dangerous side, are simply extremely annoying and painful to live with, they can cause more, you know, skin infections and other things that can require medical intervention. There's also been an increased rate of chickenpox. And in the winter, we heard an increased rate of respiratory illnesses like flu and COVID-19. Now, most of the agencies who are reporting on this don't have as much access as they had prior to the siege that started in March. So undoubtedly, this is getting worse, and summer is approaching. It becomes very hot. People become dehydrated. Undoubtedly, we will see an increased spike of infectious diseases. We're hoping that the polio vaccination campaigns that were implemented after the polio cases last summer will be successful. But undoubtedly, as this continues to go on, we will continue to see spread of infectious diseases that prior to now were not considered a problem, even in a fragile setting like Gaza.
I mean, you and others have, you know, obviously called this a form of structural violence and genocide. What does international law say about starvation as a weapon of war?
So this phrase, starvation as a weapon of war, it has, I feel like, most recently entered the general zeitgeist, but just 2 weeks after October 7th, Oxfam International was reporting that only 2% of the usual amount of food was being delivered. And their Middle East director commented then that there's no justification for using starvation as a weapon of war. Since then, including in December 2023, Human Rights Watch concluded that Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war, and the condemnations and declarations have only increased since then. The Geneva Conventions explicitly forbid starvation tactics. Quote, it is prohibited to attack, destroy, remove, or render useless objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population, such as foodstuffs, agricultural areas, crops, and livestock. And the Rome Statutes of 1998, which is the international agreement of the IC that created the ICC, also can classify starvation as a war crime. And consequentially, part of the ICC arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu and the previous defense minister of Israel includes the use of starvation as a method of warfare. So it is not only extremely illegal for whatever international law even means these days. You know, let's not forget Israel is an occupying power of the Gaza Strip, the occupying power of the Gaza Strip. They have, through the Geneva Conventions, already humanitarian obligations towards the population. Now, they have not been meeting these obligations ever. But if we're going to look into international law, we have to see where the violations began. Israel has never adhered to its responsibilities under international law. There has never been any consequences for Israel or its leaders for not doing so. And so using this, their ability now to control food entering a territory they have besieged and bombarded for almost 2 years is just a natural extension of what we have been witnessing. It's really shocking to me that people can even be shocked by this, at this point. And, you know, what many international law scholars have been warning is if we allow the guardrails to be ignored in one setting, then they're meaningless, broadly speaking. And I think now, as we're seeing this new front with Iran, we're seeing the fruits of that. And it's going to become an extremely tenuous humanitarian situation. And the, you know, again, all these institutions and guardrails and conventions and treaties that we've created to protect civilian life have been trampled on. And so what is remaining to protect civilian life? I don't honestly know. So, it is, disgusting in my view to starve a population. And I just want to add one more point. The Israeli government, through many of its senior ministers, including its prime minister, has made clear that part of the intent of its campaign in Gaza is to create such destruction and devastation that Palestinians are compelled to leave, right? And they have not made, or they have been extremely clear of these ministers and many other influential figures in Israel, that their intention is to then settle Gaza once the Palestinians have left. So we should see this starvation crisis not just as a humanitarian manifestation of a war, but as a purposeful mechanism to create displacement, to force displacement, and then create mechanisms for Palestinians to leave Gaza, those who want food, those who want medical care, those who want opportunity for their children, those who want to not live in a, you know, bombed remnants of their home. They will create mechanisms for them to leave and not come back. And what do we think will happen to Gaza in that time? They are not going to clear the rubble and for rebuilding of Palestinian infrastructure. They are going to, I believe, and they have said, so we should take them as their word, they're going to settle Gaza as part of the Israeli state. So these efforts to create this destruction, devastation, horrific conditions are part of that effort, I believe. And so they should be seen in that framing. It's not just Israel not fulfilling its obligations for food. It is Israel basically promoting a campaign of ethnic cleansing, that it's using starvation as a mechanism to do so.
Yeah, extremely important point. We'll end on this last question here. You know, as a Palestinian public health scholar, public health expert, how do you process watching this crisis unfold? And what do you think the world still misunderstands about the health dimensions of this genocide?
I'll start with the latter question. What do I think the world still misunderstands? You know, I think even for people who have absorbed the numbers of how bad it is, and we've started seeing some slight shifts in perception based on, I think, just how bad it is, how bad it looks, how bad it's been. Just talking to a single person that still lives in Gaza, or reading their testimony or seeing a video, it reminds you that there are millions, we believe, still at least 2 million, perhaps I mean, depending on what the ultimate death toll ends up being, perhaps significantly less than that. But we're going to estimate around 2 million people still left. And this is the day-to-day reality for everyone. For children, for elderly, for the people who had been classified as rich, for the people who had been classified as poor, for the people in the north, for the people in the south. Gaza is the only territory where everyone is starving. And what does that look like for these people? I mean, I can't imagine looking at my child and telling them, I have no food for you, not just today, but for the foreseeable future. And that child, you know, people have described their child's screams for food as among the most torturous sounds you can possibly hear. And there's a million of these stories, 2 million of these stories, and, you know, endless weeks and months of these experiences. So this is a, I feel that this will be looked back as one of the most horrific mass atrocities of this century, certainly. What has been allowed to happen to an entire group of people for no other reason other than where they were born and what their nationality is. And it's absolutely disgusting. And if people, I believe, both think that this will be limited to Palestinians, you know, Palestinians have been the testing ground for all sorts of weapons, for all sorts of human rights violations. And if we don't think that this will be used against other populations in the future, if starvation is okay, if we're suddenly saying starvation is okay, wow, have we really stepped back from that moral center that we thought we had found after World War II? And if starvation is okay for us, for Palestinians, then it will be utilized against other populations in the future. So I think people misunderstand the human element.
Yeah.
That these are people carrying their children to aid sites, to hospitals. And it's absolutely gut-wrenching, heartbreaking. And so that leads me into the first question is, as a Palestinian, as a health scholar, how do I process watching this? It's one thing, I think, to watch the bombings and the aftermath of that, you know, the children in ambulances, the mass bodies, the mass graves, that is a type of horror that is undescribable. To watch the weeks and months of scenes of children wasting away, starving to death, being tortured. It's torture to starve to death. It is a horrific way to die, especially when you are being partially sustained by enough calories to keep you alive, but everything else starts shutting down. It is torture. These people are being tortured. These children, these infants, all these populations we've talked about, people with disabilities, elderly folks, they're being tortured to death. It is really difficult to witness. It's very difficult to talk about. And yet, you know, I think many of us feel an obligation and duty to do so, to advocate for these people. But it really makes you just look differently at all the institutions that we are all part of, not just humanitarian law, but global health that has been so silent on this. You know, so many groups that have spoken up for other groups, you know, for example, Ukrainians are silent at the mass suffering of Palestinians. It really puts into perspective how dehumanized and how devalued Palestinian life is. And as a Palestinian, you know, that grew up in America, I thought I had an understanding of that. And this has just taken it to a whole new level. We're seeing public opinion polls changing, but extremely slowly for all the horror we've been witnessing. It's shocking to me that there's any support left for this campaign of destruction and starvation. And so I only hope that this ends immediately, that Palestinians are not just given food and medicine, but justice and accountability for those who have violated them, and genuinely to never see this in any other population ever again. And I think we should all be pushing for that.
Yes, definitely. Well, Dr. Asi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, speak with MondoWise today, and thank you for all the knowledge you've shared and for just being a voice of clarity and, on this topic and continuing to speak about it. We really appreciate you and the work that you do.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to talk to you anytime.
The Independent News news outlets, 972 Magazine and Local Call, run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists, have revealed Israel's increasingly using grenade-firing drones to enforce evacuation orders. Israeli soldiers admitted to 972 they deliberately targeted civilians so others will, quote, learn not to return to their homes. One soldier said using drones to target Palestinians was, quote, like a video game. For more, we go to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Meron Rappaport, editor and writer at the independent Israeli news site Local Call, a columnist at 972 Magazine, which published the new report headlined, Like a Video Game, Israel Enforcing Gaza Evacuations with Grenade-Firing Drones. The piece has already elicited a response from the Chinese firm Altel, which says, it never knowingly sold and authorized its drones for use by Israel's army. 972 Magazine's new piece is headlined, Autel denies selling drones to Israel. So why are they roaming Gaza's skies? Meron Rappaport, welcome back to Democracy Now! Lay out what your report reveals.
The report reveals that from the beginning of the war, Israeli soldiers started to use very simple cheap drones that were bought independently at the beginning, even by donation, from Amazon or whatever. Eventually the army turned these drones that are basically for photographing, for surveillance, they turned them into an attacking machines by adding some kind of a tool that enables these drones to throw grenades from the air and using a remote control in order to throw them in Gaza. This is quite widespread. It exists in almost all the combating units in Gaza, as far as we know, as it was not by the beginning distributed by the army itself, but bought by the soldiers themselves, by the units. It's less organized, but still, it's quite widespread.
So 972 and Local Call spoke to seven Israeli soldiers and officers who served in Gaza for the investigation. A soldier they identify as S was deployed in the Rafah area for nearly 100 days, where his battalion conducted dozens of drone strikes. S said the intention of the strikes was to kill, despite the majority of victims being located at a distance where they couldn't have been threat to soldiers. He said, quote, it was clear that they were trying to return to their homes. There's no question. None of them were armed. Nothing was ever found near their bodies. We never fired warning shots, not at any point, the soldier said. He went on to describe the aftermath visible in the drone footage. Dogs eating the bodies that weren't collected. Quote, I couldn't bring myself to watch a dog eating a body, but others around me watched it. The dogs have learned to run toward areas where they're shooting or explosions. They understand it probably means there's a body there, unquote. Another soldier identified as H, who served in central Gaza, said, quote, were they aimed at armed militants? Definitely not. Once a commander defines an imaginary red line that no one is allowed to cross, anyone who does is marked for death, unquote. In your report, you note, quote, the Palestinian journalist Yunus Tarawi published footage he had obtained of one of those drones dropping a grenade, which, according to him, targeted civilians in the Netzarim corridor in northern Gaza. On the drone controller screen, the text Iron Ball Drop Device appears. Based on the interface design and additional images reviewed by 972 and Local Call, there's strong evidence that the drone was an Autel model. Respond to all of this and the significance of Autel.
Yes, I think we have learned from these testimonies, and there were others also published by Yaniv Kubovich in Haaretz a few months ago, that the Israeli army draws some kind of imaginary lines in Gaza where Palestinians are not supposed to cross. And the way they learn that they cannot cross it is by practically shooting them. So then the other Palestinian will understand that this is a line that cannot be crossed. Now, in this, what we have described is connected also to the evacuation orders that grew in numbers and in magnitude in the last few months, in which Israel ordered the Palestinian to leave whole neighborhoods in Rafah, then in Khan Yunis, also in the north. And the way these drones were used is to sort of force this evacuation order by targeting those who were found in these areas. Either they didn't leave yet or they tried to return to their homes. So, using the drones enables the soldiers to target from afar. They don't need to be quite close to the Palestinians. It could be in 2 kilometers to 3 kilometers away because they're using drones and, of course, a TV, a screen that enables them to see what they are targeting. Now, Autel, and there are other drones, I must say, that are being used, civilian drones that are used in Gaza by other companies, Chinese companies. Autel are saying that they never authorized this, that this is against their policy, completely against their policy, that they are not, that their drones should not be used in combat areas and not target civilians. It is really not very clear how these drones arrived there, but it is quite, distributors in Israel told us that Autel is more or less aware. We don't know what's the truth there. Autel, as I said, denies that completely, categorically, and say that the distributors are not saying the truth. But the fact of the matter is that these drones are there, that they are by Chinese manufacturers, either Autel or others, and that they are used to attack civilians. This is the fact of the matter.
And finally, talk to us about that quote of an Israeli soldier who talked about the goal is for Palestinians to learn through blood.
Yes, this unfortunately is not new. As I said before, there was also a report by Yaniv Kubovich in Haaretz about 4 or 5 months ago, and again on the Netzarim corridor, where he also had the testimonies quite similar of soldiers saying that the army draws some line, and the way to implement this line is just to shoot anyone who crosses this line. And many, he said that this report also, that the great majority of them were just civilians. Now, with the drones, it is more effective because it could be, as I said, on a wider range, 2 or 3 kilometers away from where the soldiers are stationed. But the idea is the same. There is a line, and the line, the Palestinians know where the line is just by being shot at.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much, Meron Rapoport, editor and writer at the independent Israeli news site Local Call, columnist at 972 Magazine.
If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Want to kick the summer heat and get a nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at Old Farm FF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Make space noise, like choo choo choo. Make noises, okay? This is Charles Spirin, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
And when I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm saying yes to every beat. Yes, 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 this rocks. And then sometimes I switch it up like no, no, don't stop a rocking.
Every Friday morning, 8 a.m.